Welcome to Workforce RX with Futuro Health, where future-focused leaders in education, workforce development, and healthcare explore new innovations and approaches. I'm your host, Vantone Quinlevin, CEO of Futuro Health. If you don't know much about apprenticeship, prepare to be converted today as I welcome our self-described apprenticeship evangelist, Vince Kohler. Vince has deep experience working with local communities, states, and the U.S. government to determine how to make work-based learning more accessible to more people. His passion for dual professional education is rooted in the system he was exposed to growing up in his native Switzerland. In his current work as senior strategist for capacity building at Social Policy Research Associates, Vince is currently coaching several states in expanding their apprenticeship systems, including California's effort to introduce youth apprenticeships at scale, and is working at the national level to develop inclusive apprenticeship and career pathway systems. Thanks very much for joining us today, Vince.
Thanks, Vaughn, for having me. Really great to be here.
Absolutely. Well, today I opened up my email and got a newsletter from Ryan Craig, and in it was an article that had this title, Endangered Species, Good Entry-Level Jobs. And it talked about how a possible scenario of the future is that for the tasks that entry-level jobs hold, the AI can take over, and therefore the volume of entry-level roles that have no work experience will become an endangered species. What do you think about that future, Vince? And is there anything we can do about that?
Well, actually, in some ways, it argues for apprenticeship. And my wife often tells me that the answer to every question that I give is apprenticeship. And she's not wrong. But in this case, I do believe that if you have a scenario where the entry-level work, let's say that of sort of an entry-level associate, even in a law office, goes away because now AI can do a lot of those functions, then obviously training that person to a higher level is important. And there is no better way to train someone to a higher level than the untrained entry level than doing it on the job. And so I would argue that in an AI world, the need for a type of work-based post-secondary education is going to be more important. And the people who don't have access to that are going to be left behind in more dire straits than they are currently.
So the key phrase that you talked about is work-based and secondary education all in one, and this is the model of apprenticeship. So let's go into this model of apprenticeship, which is much more common and extremely well-known in Europe, but is less well-known here in the U.S. So give us a general understanding of the apprenticeship model, will you, Vince?
Sure. You know, I did grow up in Switzerland, and so I grew up in a system where, an educational environment where apprenticeship, and in particular what we think of or call youth apprenticeship in this country, is ever present. I didn't realize it was unusual at the time because you grow up in a system, you think that's the way the world is. And then later, since my professional life has been in the U.S., I realized over time, well, that is not at all how some other countries approach it. And the U.S., in some ways, in the Western industrialized world, is a little bit of an outlier, has less of the apprenticeship model than many other countries. The main difference that I see, and this is one of the reasons I often talk about the Swiss model, not because that's necessarily the best, but because it is actually very adaptable to the U.S. environment. The economies are similar. We can go into more detail about that. But the main difference that young people experience in Switzerland is that they, at age 16, can decide, do I want to go straight to university on an academic-only path, classroom-only path, or do I want to gain work experience in what they call a dual path, where I split my time between classroom and work about 50-50. And after about 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, depending on the level of apprenticeship they're aspiring to, they then graduate both from their post-secondary education. It includes what we think of as high school and something post-high school. And they graduate from their apprenticeship and they are now a regular employee. The hire into those occupations happens in high school. And what's interesting, between the two systems, about the same number of people get to four-year degrees in the U.S. as in Switzerland, about 25%. But the 75% that don't go there straight, have a pathway that gets them post-secondary education. And they often find after they've spent a few years in a workplace, oh, you know, now I want to do that master's degree in chemistry after all, because now I understand why it's helpful in my profession. Whereas in academic-only path, especially for those who sort of tire out on that model, the understanding of why that could be interesting and worthwhile just isn't there unless you've been exposed to the context within which that theoretical knowledge becomes meaningful.
Vince, can I ask you, I understand the academic path is one where, for example, you're the student, you pay the tuition check, and so that's pretty clear how that model would work. So in the dual model, who pays for tuition, for example? Is it out of the pocket of the student, or is it the employer or some other entity?
Yeah, I think that's probably one of the big benefits to students is this whole equation around what does education cost, right? In high school, we understand up to high school, education should be free. Many states extend that now to some extent into the community colleges. But what in apprentice experiences in a system, say, for example, again, the Swiss as an example, is that even in high school, they start earning a wage. So if they spend 50% of their time in the workplace, they get a wage. It's not very high. It's a training wage. It's $1,500 a month. In the second year, it's probably $2,000 a month. But I can tell you, as someone who's experienced this myself, I did the academic path. My buddies had $1,500 a month. It probably wasn't quite that much when I went to school, but still, it was way more. So they were, you know, driving a motorcycle when I was on the moped, or driving a moped when I was on the bicycle. So they were always ahead financially, which is interesting because you think of the academic path to the lawyer and the doctor as maybe being the more lucrative. But in reality, it is the work-based learning, the dual path, that is the more lucrative. And today, in those countries that do this in a widespread way, there's more equity between those paths and the academic path. And there is, heads of banks and captains of industry took that path. And industry itself looks at people who've crossed over, who've done both, favorably. They would rather have a engineer who has practical experience than an engineer who just comes from, you know, MIT, if they have a choice between the two. So that's how it actually pays off. And so the difference in a lifetime of earning on average is about $300,000 between someone who does the work-based learning path and someone who doesn't. And the other thing that's interesting when you look at the statistics, in a downturn, economic downturn, the people who get laid off first and those that get rehired first, the people with work-based learning experience have the fewest unemployment weeks in their lifetime, fewer than people who have academic-only skills. Because it turns out you actually need people who know how to do things, not just who know how to think. So that's a little bit of that differential between do you have the work-based path or not.
So is the work environment a better place for learning than most schools? I mean, is it a better learning environment that is more inspiring for high schoolers and frankly, even college students to actually complete their education?
You know, I wouldn't say it's the better environment. I think we've been expecting things of education that education, I mean, and I mean by that classroom education, just can't deliver. And I honestly sometimes feel like we are hard on educators for reasons that are beyond their control and that they shouldn't be held responsible for. Employers say, oh, you know, you educators don't prepare your students for the workplace. They're not ready when they come to us. But we don't ask the question about, well, what's your role in this? Why don't you help us? And the reality is, a classroom is not a good environment to prepare someone for everything the working life requires. And that's obvious when we think about it. We don't say a pilot should get into his 747 and fly 300 people around without ever having, you know, from a manual, right? We expect them to have done it a lot in simulators and then in actual planes and then in planes with passengers where they're the co-pilot. There is a whole pathway. That's all an apprenticeship. Surgeons don't get to operate on my brain without having done it a lot. And having gone through, you know, we call it a residency, it's really an apprenticeship. So we do this in all the jobs that really, really matter. And yet then we expect certain jobs to just, okay, go to college. And then you magically will know what the workplace requires. So I think it's fit for purpose. The classroom is very good at certain things. We have to know the context. We have to know history. That's not something you're going to learn in a workplace. But it's not very good at teaching you the latest CNC machine. And in fact, even there, I find educators sometimes get put into roles where we're excited when a new lab gets inaugurated at a community college, which costs, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars or maybe even millions. And the reality is the workplace has that machinery all the time. It gets upgraded. The companies has to keep upgrading it. It's there. Meanwhile, the classroom is probably going to fall behind. Next time, you know, 5 years from now, those robots are going to be outdated and there's not going to be the money to replace them. The sort of macroeconomic benefit, and I see this in Switzerland all the time, what employers put into that system is enormous. They spend 70% of the cost of the dual education system in Switzerland gets paid for by employers because they provide the workplace and they provide the wages, and that's 70% of the cost. The classroom is the classroom is the classroom. It's there as well, but it actually costs a little less because the students are in the workplace half the time, which means teachers have more time for preparation. You can even pay them a little more because they're actually serving basically half the number of students if you look at it that way. And you can actually really, really focus on the classroom portion in a new way. So there are a number of benefits. So I wouldn't say one is better than the other. I will say, though, that, you know, there's some surveys. Recently, there was one in Colorado where they asked employers, which is the better place to learn which skills, the workplace or the classroom? Employers said, of a big list of skills, they said the only thing that the classroom is better at is math and communication. And they said math is not that important, frankly. Communication is very important. They also ranked it in importance. On the right side, the workplace side, they said everything else, workplace skills, employability skills or soft skills, team building, you name it, it was all on the workplace side. They just didn't think that it was, frankly, the educator's job to do this. So I think the key there is to turn employers into not just consumers of talent, but producers or co-producers of talent. There's a number of reasons why that's better, but that we can get into. But the key benefit, I think, is that we let educators shine where they're best able to shine, and we don't force stuff onto them that really they're not equipped to do.
This call to action of yours, which is turning employers into co-producers of talent. What a great phrase. The model rests on the participation of employers. And in a way, you could argue that in the last few decades, employers have been actually shying away from having a role, having a big role, because the tenure of employees are getting shorter and of all the pressures on them. So what can be done for employers to really buy into this concept? Because this model only works with the employers at the table, right?
I think they have to be shown how it works and the benefits of it. And taking the vision of the talent development a step further, imagine a world where employers go to high schools to find talent the way they go to high schools to find talented athletes, right? They do that currently, right? It's a pathway to get at the talent. It's kind of odd when you think about it that for athletics, we do it. But for employment, we don't do it. And my sense is that that talent is out there. There should be competition for that talent. And I will tell you, in Switzerland, that competition exists. There are 60,000 unfilled apprenticeship slots every year in Switzerland. That means it's an apprentices market. And that means if you're a good employer that wants good talent in your company, you go to those high schools and you recruit. for the apprenticeship position of a 16 and 17 year old, the same way you would if you thought this guy or this girl is superb at soccer or at, you know, ultimate frisbee. So I think there is a way in which employers are both demonstrated that this works, and they have to be shown, because we don't have it in our DNA to do it, except in construction where everybody understands that's the way to go. We have to basically demonstrate it. I can tell you that in places like, for example, South Carolina Community College has this system with companies where they started the signing day, which the first time they had 10 or 15 employers and maybe 20 students and parents. Now this is like standing room only. Companies show up. They want to recruit. When somebody's hired, they get the T-shirt of that company. It becomes like March Madness in a high school, or actually in this case, a community college, but they're actually recruiting high school students. And so there's a process which after a while you reach the tipping point and then it becomes the new normal. We have a ways to get there to create that environment, but employers will listen to other employers better than to anyone else. And so that's why we have to have some proof points. We have those in the US as well, that we can point to and say, look, check out how they do it. And over time, I think we will reach that tipping point.
I mentioned in my introduction that you're working with a number of states to introduce and improve the adoption of apprenticeship as a model. What are the levers that states or public policy makers, what do they have as levers in order to increase adoption?
I think simplifying access is probably the biggest lever, and that requires often some changes to the bureaucracy that currently governs how education and workforce programs collaborate. This varies from state to state. So this really is typically has to be handled at the state level. And really, traditionally, apprenticeship, because it sits between education and workforce, doesn't have a natural home. And we have to think of it as an education program, I think, that's very important, and not just as a workforce preparation program, because it does post-secondary education in the workplace. It requires that we give credit to those the skills that are learned. So I would say finding a home for the reform effort, to the extent that reform is required, is important. Giving credit to work-based learning and giving equal credit to whether you're doing the work-based path or the academic path is very important. In the US, it's very important that an associate degree accompanies the completion of an apprenticeship ultimately, because otherwise you're closing off the next degree to those who take the work-based learning path. And one of the things that's very important for this to work, this model, is that you can cross over from one side, the academic path, to the dual path easily. That's a lesson that the European models had to learn as well. They didn't do that in the sort of 70s, 80s, even into the 90s. And they lost a lot of potential apprentices because they said, well, you know, I'm not sure that I'm going to be successful if I don't take the academic path. The other policy levers have to do with incentives in some cases, although I will say, we often think we have to fund apprenticeship. I mentioned Ryan Craig's book. He is, I think, a bit of a believer in that. I'm less of a believer in funding apprenticeships, and certainly not wage subsidies, which I'm sure Ryan would agree don't need to be subsidized. But I don't think we should do too much on the incentives front, except for making the system very, very easy for employers to engage with. We have hundreds of community colleges in California. Just as an example, we have 1,000 school districts. Employers can't be dealing with all of those, or even in a, you know, LA basin, you're dealing with so many institutions. They can't be doing this. They need some intermediaries that can make it simple to become a hosting company, to recruit apprentices online, to download some standards for the training, to track whatever the government needs from them in order to be tracking the employees properly. All of that should be way, way easier than it currently is. And so there's a lot of work that states can do, and that often has to happen at the state level. Some legislation is often required. And we have examples for that. States have made that progress, have been the early adopters. So there's model legislation that's available. If another state wants to pick it up, they can look to.
I would love for you to share with us like an exemplar of an employer apprenticeship program and their structure here in the United States, and also an exemplar from a state that has done a good job at cultivating apprenticeships. Do you have examples?
The early adopter of all the states was Wisconsin. Again, I'm focusing on youth apprenticeship because the average apprentice in the U.S. is 30 years old. Youth apprenticeship in Europe, the average age is about 17. The reason that as an economy, we need to get the average age down, and we really have to go into high schools for this, is that at that time in a young person's life, the training wages make sense. But when you are 30 and you have a family and you have, you know, you're trying to buy a house or whatever, you have obligations, then the apprenticeship wage, the lower wage, is very, very tough to do. And then employers have to ask themselves, well, now this is the positive return on investment that I can get if I work with a high schooler is not the same. But also, if you look at the other way, we have a big cliff after high school where there's a way too large number of young people that are not finding the transition into the world of work. And at some point, they may get there, but these 6 or 7 years of delay, they are really incredibly impactful on the communities that these young people come from, on those families, and they can never catch up. And so we have to give them a better connection earlier on. And so I think that's one of the reasons. So the examples that I would cite are Wisconsin was the early adopter. In the 90s, they started their program. Colorado is a more recent and maybe most advanced of the recent adopters of the states. Washington State has followed a similar model. And now Indiana, South Carolina, I already mentioned, New York, Washington, D.C. Those states are mostly following the Swiss model or Central European model. And they take delegations to Switzerland. Usually there's an institute there that where they can study it. They can compare notes. And I would say examples are interesting. I mean, I was at a presentation at JP Morgan Chase in their big tower. They've made an investment, significant investment into apprenticeship. And there was this young person, a young man with his mother talking about the experience of being an apprentice. And he said, the first time, the apprentice himself said, first time I walk into this building, I'm thinking, I don't belong here. He's African-American. I don't know. I think they're the biggest bank in the country. I'm walking in there. I have a job. I'm going to the 45th floor. And I'm becoming an IT apprentice at JP Morgan Chase. And his mother is listening to this. And she says, you know, I believe in my son, but he didn't believe that he belonged here. And now he's here. Now he's, and this young man built a piece of software that is now standard software being used by JP Morgan Chase at 17 or 18. And so the example that I see when I see these programs get implemented in the US is the exact same thing that we see in Europe. These young people are incredibly capable. They have to be trusted. They have to, you know, trust and verify, but trust that you are able to do these things. And where we often look at young people as sort of risk factors, oh my God, can we really let them be on the shop floor? Are they going to break things? Are they going to get injured? Well, they're going to behave in a way that is expected of them. And the capabilities that these young people display when given those responsibilities are tremendous. And what it does to their self-perception and to the perception in the community about who they are is transformational for sure.
Well, I love that example of JP Morgan Chase because it's a white-collar job that you normally don't associate with apprenticeship. So thank you for that example. Vince, since we started with AI, let's close or second to my last question. It has to do with AI. What do you think the impact of AI is on the apprenticeship model?
Yeah, this is a nice to close the loop again. AI will have the effect. I mean, all predictions about AI are wrong, so I'll make a wild prediction of my own, is that it will eliminate a lot of jobs. It will change a lot of jobs, and it will create new fields and new skills will emerge. I do a presentation on apprenticeship that I entitled that the future of learning is work, which is a little bit of a play on words because I was in a series of talks with someone who said the future of work is learning, and both are true, but I'm more right than they are because I actually think that in times of transition, figuring out what the future workplace holds is especially important. And we, again, this is in line with what I said earlier about what we expect of educators. We think that a community college or an institution of higher learning can predict what skills are needed in 5-10 years. And frankly, that's not possible. And because it's not possible, we have to allow educational institutions to teach what is kind of universal. We will be talking to each other. We will be writing to each other. We will be needing to understand our own history of thought, of discourse, and so forth. But we will not know what software will be in place. We will not know what AI can do for us. I'm amazed every day by what AI can do that I didn't know yesterday it could do. And 90% of the things that it can do, I have no clue about. When the transition in the workplace is so rapid, then the model of apprenticeship is particularly appropriate because in my view, apprenticeship is a look into the future. You are actually in the workplace. You don't have to predict what things will be like in 10 years. The workplace will evolve and you will evolve with it. I was visiting an apprenticeship program here near where I live on the Monterey Peninsula. It's in Marina. It's electric air taxis that are being built and apprentices are being shown how to build it. And the skills they have to have, they don't even have descriptions for them because this kind of aircraft has never existed. There is no rule book to go to. There is no classroom training. You have to build it from scratch. But the company can't wait until those courses are developed by some educational institution. They're building it as they go. And that's, again, an example where the future readiness of an apprenticeship system is ideal. And it's ironic that one of the oldest methods of training that we assume humans ever deployed, which is like you look at the person next to you and you figure out how did they use the rock, and then you learn that you could use the rock a little better yourself, is still so appropriate in the most modern work environment. But that's why I do believe that AI, the impact it has on apprenticeship models is that it makes them probably more useful and more prevalent. And again, going right back to the beginning, if the gap that will emerge between where someone is when they finish a classroom-based education and all those activities that an AI system can do and what the human still is needed for, if that becomes too great, then we have inequality grow further. And the gap between those who can make that jump and those who can't be that much greater. I would say one more thing that I didn't mention earlier about the impact of having apprenticeship widely available. It's not just that there's an income flow to the people who are in an apprenticeship program, but the cost of education goes to zero or again becomes actually a revenue center. For example, JP Morgan Chase, as well as some other companies, Aon is an insurance company and another white collar apprenticeship user. They pay for education for their apprentices. They cover 100% of the tuition if an apprentice of theirs wants to go to the next level. That's true for a lot of apprenticeship providers. If you want to become an engineer at a train manufacturer that I visited in Utah, they will pay half the tuition in that case, and they want you to become an engineer on their dime or half their dime, I would say, and you have an income while you're doing it. So that is again, turning something that is, you know, in the U.S., resulting in billions in student debt into the opposite, a positive income flow.
Vince, let's wrap up this podcast with one final question. What's your final word on the future of apprenticeship 10 years from now?
Yeah, that's a good question. I often start my talks with a little visioning exercise where I ask those in the audience to close their eyes and I draw a little future for them, maybe somewhat idealized in my mind, about where we could be 10 years from now. And usually what that future holds is that apprenticeship is widespread in every occupation. Again, white collar, blue collar, and everything in between, green collar. And essentially, every job that requires a certain level of skill is accessible through an apprenticeship. So my sense is we could, in 10 years, make that available to virtually every high school student in, say, in California. Washington State has that stated goal. And in fact, it's sooner than in 10 years, but they started probably earlier. So for them, it will be a 10-year horizon. And what that will do is, if we took a state the size of California, it will put about $8 billion in disposable income into those young people's pockets. It will do almost the exact opposite to the debt. So their educational debt will be reduced by $8 to $9 billion. And the investment that employers make into those careers of those young people is in the neighborhood of $13 billion. That is doable. And we did the math about how many apprentices a state of California, the size of California, could handle. The U.S. currently has about 500,000 apprentices. California alone, if it was operating at the level that the economy needs and could handle, would have 650,000 apprentices. It currently has about 100,000. So that's the future that I envision. That's sort of the macro future. The micro future is that, again, I take the example of Joby, this aircraft manufacturer here in the Salinas Valley. They're recruiting currently the children of farm workers in the Salinas Valley to build these planes. And the reason they're doing it here, partly there's a proximity to Silicon Valley that is meaningful. But the reason they're recruiting here is that they cannot afford to import labor from elsewhere, because the labor cannot afford to live here. But those kids of these farm workers, they already live here. But they don't have a sense of a future. They don't want to be farm workers themselves, per se, although they might be willing to operate a robot that, you know, does the farm work for them, and that's also in the future. So for them, it is a path toward a meaningful and well-compensated job that allows them to live where they currently live and not have to move elsewhere. So I think there are a lot of benefits of that kind of a future. I think we can get there. I think the governor's goal, in the case, again, California, the governor's goal of getting to 500,000 requires definitely that we do it starting with high schools and add a lot of high schools to this mix. And that's the other exciting part in California. We are at a point where there are new plans coming to fruition. The California Youth Apprenticeship Committee has just finished up its work, and the final report is coming out soon. The master plan for career education that the governor is working on is in the works, and that would also, I think, reinvent career education in California in a significant way. So I think we're in a good time when it comes to the potential for apprenticeship to actually becoming a reality for a lot of people in the U.S. in general and in California specifically.
Well, you certainly delivered in terms of us calling you an apprenticeship evangelist. We learned so much doing this time with you, Vince. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
I'm Vantone Quinlivan with Futura Health. Thanks for checking out this episode of Workforce RX. I hope you will join us again as we continue to explore how to create a future-focused workforce in America.